This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava.
And I'm Kathleen Harris.
And welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, since it's the holiday season, Kathleen and I are going to take the next 2 weeks to talk about different kinds of gifting. No, we're not going to be talking about the kind of stuff you put underneath the Christmas tree. We're going to be talking about gifting assets to charities, to friends, and even to family members.
And in the second half of our program, Jim will be talking with attorney Lou Mazzullo of McKenna, Long & Aldridge about year-end tax planning. So something a little bit more broad than our first discussion about charitable gifting. We'll be talking more about other strategies you might want to think about in terms of year-end tax planning for individuals and for small businesses as well. So make sure you stay tuned for the second half of our program.
And also, since this is that time of the year, I want to cover the topic of gifting to charity, because when you get down to this time of the year, people are scrambling at the last minute. You're thinking, okay, what can I do? Maybe you've met with your accountant. He's told you what your quarterly estimates are going to be, or you're looking at your capital gains, and people are always looking at what can I do towards the end of the year to get a deduction? Because remember, folks, December 31st, the year ends, and there's not too many things that you can do afterwards. We have covered pension contributions, whether it's a 401k or setting up a simple IRA or things that you can do that if they're set up by the end of the year, you have till you file your tax returns and extensions to fund them. But we're going to talk about another way to get a deduction, and one is through gifting to charity. Now, many of you are aware, if you give to Goodwill or let's say you're given to your church, you get an itemized deduction on your tax return. And last week we covered some of the phase out of those itemized deductions. You can lose up to 3% of your adjusted gross income depending on what your income level is. So if you want to know what those numbers are, go back and listen to last week's program. But before the close of the tax year, one deduction you can get is those gifts to charity, whether you're making cash gifts or you're making gifts of assets of one kind or another, or even donations to Goodwill. Now, how much you get as an itemized deduction is going to depend on your adjusted gross income. That's the figure on the bottom of the front page of your tax return. Now, depending, of course, the higher the income and the charity that you give to, those deductions may be 20 or 30% of the gifts that are being made. Now, there are several IRS publications out there. And if you want to do your own homework, if you don't have a tax advisor, there are IRS publications 526, 561, and 1771. So you get a lot of details because it does impact in terms of what kind of assets you're giving away. In other words, whether they're cash or, let's say, appreciated stock or real estate. And you got to be real careful, folks, when you get into real estate. There's all kinds of rules that come in there. So if you're thinking of giving away a real estate to a charity, please do yourself a favor and talk to a tax advisor before you do something like that. But the important thing is you can make a gift around this time of the year and you can get a tax deduction, which can help bring your itemized deductions. And remember this year, for a lot of you that are single and a lot of you that are married, there are all kinds of tax brackets. And once again, I refer to last week's show. There's one tax bracket for income taxes, $400,000 single, $450,000. If you are married, there's another bracket at $250,000 single, $300,000 for the phase out of itemized deductions and personal exemptions. And there's another bracket of $250,000 that determines the Medicare tax. So it really would behoove you, if you're considering making these deductions, to know where you stand in terms of your tax bracket.
I think what I also found interesting, Jim, too, is that I think we're pretty familiar with people doing a tithe or some sort of gift to their church or certain other specific charity organizations like those that help animals, for example. But I was pretty surprised that there's a pretty broad range of organizations that have qualified to be charitable organizations with the IRS. Just things like I was thinking about, you know, if you gift something to a state, which I had never crossed my mind you could do that, But if you give property, for example, to a state to add on to a state park or create a state park, that's tax deductible. If you want to give to some kind of community organization that's formed for a charitable purpose, like let's just say a zoo or the museum. So if people wanted to give money to the San Diego Zoo, for example, that's also tax deductible. Like we mentioned, there's also the tithes and offerings people give to their churches and synagogues, pretty common deduction for a lot of people. Something else I think that's been a lot in the news lately is dealing with our veterans that have been coming back from the various conflicts and wars we've been involved in for the past several decades. And there are a lot of great organizations out there as well that qualify as charitable organizations. I'm thinking about things, Jim, like the Wounded Warrior Project or Homes for Our Troops, for example. Really great organizations to help our soldiers who are coming back from these conflicts to get back on their feet. Volunteer fire companies. Never had even crossed my mind you could do that. Things like civil defense organizations like the Civil Air Patrol. Fraternal societies, Knights of Columbus, Shriners, Elks. All those types of things qualify as charitable organizations. And something else I found out when I was looking into this a little bit more, Jim, is there are a lot of nonprofit cemetery companies you can donate to as well, likely having to do with specific burial plots for different types of maybe perhaps historic burial plots and that sort of thing that need to be maintained. So really a wide variety of causes to donate to, Jim. A lot of great websites out there that can help you find and research various different charities to see if they're, you know, in good standing in terms of their use of the monies and how various different organizations rate them in terms of their reliability and use of funds. So if you're thinking that you might be able to benefit from a charity, some kind of charitable donation, but aren't really sure where you want that money to go, got a ton of resources out there on the internet as far as rating and ranking some of these different types of organizations you can possibly give to.
And also, I want to point out, giving to some political organization or a candidate does not qualify for an itemized deduction. So we're going to talk next week about gifting to specific individuals. Let's say you want to make a gift to a grandchild or children or a friend. There's a whole set of tax rules that come into play. Just want to let you know that's a whole separate topic by itself, and we're going to cover that on our final lifetime income program of the year, which will be coming up next week. Now, one of the things that happens around this time of the year, and especially if you've rolled over your pension or you have an IRA, once you turn age 70 and a half, you have to start taking what is called a required minimum distribution. Now, this does not apply if you have a Roth IRA. However, there is something that got extended for this year, and this may be the last year to do this, that you can give up to $100,000 distribution from your IRA directly to a charitable organization. So you don't get a deduction, but the money that you have to take out of your IRA, which would be normally taxable income, is non-taxable. So you don't get a deduction, but it's not included in your taxable income. So for many of you out there that if you're fortunate enough to have, let's say, a large IRA as a result of a rollover of a corporate pension plan or company pension plan, and you're taking these required minimum distributions, and you're saying, you know what, we really don't need it. I'd like to donate it to my church or charity. If you give them to a charitable organization, now the distributions usually include an option to send a check to a third party, but the important part, it will reduce your taxable income, meaning the income that comes out of the IRA goes directly to the charity, does not get included on your tax return. This does not apply, however, to 401k plans. It only applies to IRAs only, and it does not apply to Roth IRAs.
We had a couple of clients who've taken advantage of this year because, again, this is likely to be the last year that the IRS is going to allow people to do this special type of distribution from their IRAs. Is, you know, we have a couple actually that works with us. They've been with us for a long, long time. Now in their mid-70s, really, really involved in their church. Longtime members of the choir, part of the church's historical society, really involved in their community. And they're fairly well off. They have multiple sources of income, different types of investments that they have, different rental properties, and they have a pretty sizable IRA portfolio as well. And so their required minimum distribution every year is pretty sizable. It's probably around $50,000 this year. And the truth of the matter is, Jim, they really just don't need that much income. And they're sort of right on the edge of one of the tax brackets, moving from 25% to 28%. So what they decided to do this year was take part of the required minimum distribution as a normal distribution to themselves. They could spend it or reinvest it or whatever they wanted to do with it. But then they thought they would also just take a portion of their required minimum distribution and give it directly to their church through their distribution from their IRA. And they were very blessed in the fact that that small distribution they made to their church is going to actually reduce their tax bracket because it's going to reduce their taxable income. So instead of taking their full required minimum distribution just for themselves, they decided to set aside a portion, send it directly to their church, and it's actually reducing their tax bracket for the year. So that's a smart strategy in two ways. It allows you to gift to an organization that you really have an emotional and perhaps a philosophical connection to. So that benefits the charitable organization, and it also can benefit you financially in terms of reducing your tax bracket. So for them, it was a win-win situation.
Yeah, and this is something that's really important when you're doing tax planning. And once again, I highly recommend, if you're not a tax expert, to really speak with either a financial planner or your CPA and have them take a look at what your marginal tax bracket is, because that's what your deductions are going to save you. So in other words, in this couple that Kathleen just talked about, they were going to move into a 28% tax bracket at $150,000 of income. Now, by making that $5,000 contribution to charity, it knocked them below $150,000 down to $145,000, kept them in a 25% tax bracket. So the contribution virtually paid for itself in terms of pushing them down into a lower bracket. And that's the number that you really need to know, is what your marginal tax bracket is. In other words, the next dollar of income or the next dollar of deduction, how much are you going to save? Now, most people think about when you make a contribution at the end of the year, you know, you're giving money to your church or charity. There's other things that you can contribute to charities and get a deduction for. Now, most people are familiar with the cash deduction, but you can gift shares of stocks, you can give bonds, mutual funds, investment assets directly. What you need to do is contact the organization for their investment account information. Let's say you're going to transfer 100 shares of IBM to the charity. Make sure that charity has an investment account open. You want to contact your financial institution for the instructions how to get the shares over. You can also give things like physical assets, property, real estate, cars, paintings, clothing. We're all familiar with Salvation Army around this time of the year. Household goods. The important thing is you really need to contact the organization for instructions how to give the physical assets, so that you want to make sure that you're complying and you're following all the rules, because there's all kinds of rules about asset transfers. I talked about, for example, if you want money to go directly from your IRA to a charitable organization. The important thing is really understand what your marginal tax bracket is, how much of a gift can make a big difference. As Kathleen mentioned, in that one couple, that one $5,000 gift knocked them down from a 28% tax bracket down to a 25% tax bracket. And not to confuse you, but it's a reason why I would like to see you talk to a financial planner or, let's say, your tax advisor. There are so many different tax brackets that come into effect this year. There's the Bush tax brackets, depending on your income, and now we have the new Obama tax brackets. We have different brackets for itemized deductions. We have different brackets for exemptions. We have different brackets for the Medicare tax. We have different deduction amounts based on the type of charity and the type of gift that you're making. So the important thing is you can get a deduction, but you really need to know what the rules are and know what your tax bracket is before you make these gifts.
You're making a really great point here, Jim, because in some cases, your charitable contribution can be up to 50% of your AGI. In other cases, only 20% or 30%. So you're right. You definitely need to understand the type of asset you're gifting and what the contribution limits are for that. I was going to say, too, it should come as absolutely no surprise to our listeners out there that the IRS is going to be a demon for documentation about these gifts that you're making. So typically speaking, any gift over $250 is going to require some kind of written receipt, some kind of proof of the gift, whether it's something on maybe you're making automatic contributions so you can show a bank statement that shows the funds going into the charity. Whatever it is, you're going to need some kind of documentation of proof of the contribution. And if you're making a non-cash contribution, those require special forms from the IRS. Usually you're going to do a form 8283. And if you're donating something that's a non-cash asset that's over $5,000, you're going to need to have a qualified appraiser make an appraisal of that. It's going to have to be part of your records as well. So again, no surprise to anyone, the IRS is going to want to have paperwork, paperwork, paperwork to back up everything that you're claiming as a charitable contribution for the year. We had a client, Jim, who came to me who wanted to make a cash contribution to one of her favorite charities. She's really big horse lover and contributes to a lot of charities that have to do with rehabilitating horses who maybe were polo ponies or race horses and weren't really being used anymore by their owners, and they're being retrained to be riding animals, for example. And she came to me wanting to make a cash contribution to these charities, and she said, well, can you sell some stock for me so that we can make this contribution to these charities? And I said, well, have you ever thought about just gifting some stock? And she was pretty surprised. I think a lot of people out there don't realize you can actually gift stock directly to a charitable organization as long as they have some kind of investment account set up somewhere. So she went ahead and she thought about it for a little bit. She said, you know, that makes a lot of sense to go ahead and gift a stock. And from a tax perspective, Jim, it can be, again, another example of this win-win situation. Just like when you make a direct contribution from an IRA to a charitable organization, it maximizes that contribution to the charity and helps you minimize your tax bill. Something similar happens when you donate gifts of stock to a charity. Let me just give an example of what I mean by this. Let's say that you had 100 shares of stock and you purchased it at $10 a share, so your cost was $1,000. You've been lucky, now the stock is worth $10,000. So you've held the stock for more than a year. If you wanted to sell the stock and get the proceeds to the charity, since you held the stock for more than a year, it's going to be taxed at the long-term capital gains rate of 15%. What that's going to mean is that if you sell the stock and send the proceeds to the charity, you're only going to be able to gift them net $8,650 because of the eventual tax implication of that particular sale of stock. Now, on the other hand, if you've held the stock for more than a year and you gift the stock directly to the charity, they can get that stock at the exact valuation it is on the day of the gift. And so you can gift the entire amount, that full $10,000 worth of stock goes to the charity, which also means your deduction is that full $10,000 and not the $8,650. So net-net, the charity gets more money and you get a bigger deduction. So in many situations, gifting stock directly to a charity can be a great way of maximizing your gift to them and the tax deduction for you. Just a few tips for those of you who are listening to me and thinking, ah, great idea, Kathleen, I'm totally going to do that. Just keep in mind before you do that, you'll need to make sure that you've held the stock for at least a year. And when you're figuring out the value of the contribution to the charity, you're going to take the average of the high and low prices for the publicly held stock on the day of the transfer. And again, there's some limits to the deductibility of gifts on appreciated property. So typically speaking, this is 30% of your AGI for appreciated assets. So the good news is that amounts that you can't apply to this year's tax return can be applied to next year's tax return. So really net-net, Jim, if you're thinking about making a contribution to a charity and you've got some highly appreciated stock, can be a really great way to move that stock into another situation that's going to really maximize your tax deduction and maximize your gift to the charity so that they can make the best use of the funds you're giving over to them.
Now, I want to talk about another concept when it comes to gifting, and especially to charities, where you can get a deduction. Let's just take a situation. I'm going to give you a case study of one of our larger clients. But let's say you had your own company, and you got bought out by a public company, so you're sitting on a lot of appreciated stock of a public company that's liquid. Or, you know, you were fortunate enough to be a good investor. Maybe you worked for a company, you had stock options, and over the years you've accumulated a lot of assets in a particular company. Now, what you can do, which is sort of a win-win situation, is you can deduct, and let's just, I don't know, let's make this easy. Let's just take $100,000. Let's say you have a $100,000 value in a particular stock. You really would like to get the dividends from it. It's a good company. The dividends are going up. But as far as your estate is concerned, you know, you're not so much concerned that it remains in the estate. Now, what you can do is set up what is called a charitable remainder trust. You can transfer the $100,000 stock to the trust. And what can happen then is you can sell that stock or you can invest in something that pays more income. You can get a tax deduction for the amount of stock transferred to the trust. Now, that's going to be based on the amount of money you take each year from the trust. And you can do it like a husband and wife can say, look, as long as we're living, we want a 4 or 5% return from this $100,000. So each year you would get $5,000. You can base it on both your lives. You can even extend it onto your children. Obviously, the further out that the charity gets the deduction, in other words, depending on your age, depending on your distribution rate, there's a whole bunch of rules that come into play here. But the important point is you can donate a highly appreciated asset to a charity and avoid paying the capital gains because, let's put it this way, if you're in one of those high tax brackets, so let's say you're a married couple and you're making over $450,000, and let's say you live here in the state of California, you're going to be subject to 20% federal tax. You're going to be subject to another 3.8% Obamacare tax. So let's round that off to 24%. In California here, depending on your income, your tax bracket could be 9.3% to almost 13.3%. So if you think about it, well over a third of your gains are going to go to the tax man. So instead of paying a third of your capital gains, you can donate it to a charitable remainder trust and almost get a third of it in the form of a tax deduction, once again, depending on age and distribution rate. And it works out very, very well because it's a way that a lot of times people have a particular asset, maybe a paid for real estate. Real estate gets a little bit more complicated, especially if you have debt. So you really need to know what you're doing here if you're donating real estate. But let's assume that you have highly appreciated stock. And you're saying, you know, the stock doesn't really pay me that much in dividends, but boy, I have so many gains in this stock. I just hate to give away a third or 35% of the gain of this stock to the government because that's really going to reduce what I have afterwards. This is something where you really want to sit down with a planner and talk about the benefits of setting up a charitable remainder trust where you actually don't part with the asset. It goes to this trust. And during your lifetime, or depending how you set it up, all the assets from the trust, the income is paid to you directly. So you're enjoying the benefit of the asset. But eventually down the road, however you set it up, eventually it's going to go to a charity. Now, we had a case where a very, very wealthy couple, a gentleman, he had a company, a very, very successful company. He was also very successful that the company owned real estate. And he had rental properties, had ranches, and so quite a fluent couple. And he was getting to that point in his life where he really wanted to slow down. And one of the companies that he dealt with offered to buy his business. And so he came to us, we took a look at it, and we took a look at his cost basis in his business. And then we took a look at what he had ended up paying taxes. Now, this was during the Clinton era where the tax rates were as high as they are now. If you're in that upper income level, his tax bracket would have been 40% at the federal level. They would have been 9% here at the state level. So he was in a very, very high tax bracket. What we decided to do, because he had Social Security income for him and his wife, he had investment income that was substantial, and we had a lot of that in tax-free bonds and then some in dividend-paying stocks. He had rental properties. He had farm properties that were producing income. So really, the business at this point in his life, he no longer really needed the assets per se. So what we decided is we took a look at donating the stock. In other words, he was going to sell the company to another public company. In exchange, there would have been no taxable event. He would have held shares in the new company. His stock would have been exchanged for the new public company stock. And so there's no gains in that. But had he sold the stock once he got it, which is what he wanted to do, because he didn't want to have all the assets tied up in that particular company because they paid no income. And so what we did is he sold his company in exchange for stock in a public corporation. And then what we did is we transferred the public stock to a charitable remainder trust. Now, the way we set it up is he took a distribution rate at somewhere, I'm trying to think, it was like 4 or 5%. And the way we set it up, it was going to go to three charities upon the death of both he and his wife. Now, he has since passed on. He passed away in 2010. But the distributions from that charitable trust continue to this day. And the distributions are much bigger because we did this in 1999 at the beginning of the year. And the 5% distribution rate is based on the assets held in the trust. And the assets held in the trust now are 2.5 to 3 times higher than when we donated the stock because of gains that we've made in managing the assets. And so the income is almost threefold. But the important point is we were able to take a stock. He got substantial tax deductions for doing it instead of paying out substantial capital gains taxes. And on top of that, he got an income during his lifetime, which continues on to this day to his wife at a much higher rate, almost 2 to 3 times what it was when we donated the stock initially to the charitable remainder trust. Because remember, the public stock that he got when he sold his company didn't pay a dividend. We were able to sell the stock, invest it in dividend paying assets. Those assets have grown over the last 13, 14 years and now represent a substantial size. Actually, there were three charities, and there's enough assets now in that trust that each charity will get the equivalent of what he originally put into that charitable remainder trust. So this gets a little bit more complicated. It's something that you definitely want to consider talking with a tax advisor, because there's all kinds of implications. There's a much different deduction, and you got to be real careful here if you're transferring real estate, especially if you have real estate with debt. You could get caught in a tax trap. But if you do have substantial assets, this is something you may want to consider, where you're thinking maybe you live in a high tax state like California, where you're saying, boy, between what I'm going to pay and federal capital gains taxes in the state of California, they're going to take over a third of my gains. I don't want to do that. Well, here's another method of doing it. You get a tax deduction instead of paying taxes and enjoy the income from that asset during your entire lifetime or even more.
I think what I like about all this idea, Jim, is it's really win-win. You get to make a contribution to something that means something to you, and at the same time, you get a tax benefit. So really, it's a win-win. Why don't we just remind our listeners, Jim, what we've talked about so far today? We talked about taking a portion of your required minimum distribution from your IRA and contributing it directly to a charity. Again, that's not tax deductible in this particular case, but what it does is it reduces your overall taxable income. The second idea we talked about was gifting real assets, whether they're shares of stocks or bonds, or maybe things like cars or painting or real estate, that those are things that you can do for your charity as well. We also talked about charitable remainder trusts. So if any of these ideas seem to be something that's of interest to you, make sure you contact the charity and see what they're willing to accept in terms of donations, what they have set up in terms of receiving those assets. And also make sure you discuss this with your tax advisor. And if you're thinking about setting up a charitable remainder trust, make sure you discuss this with an estate attorney, qualified tax attorney, so you make sure that this documentation is set up correctly. Because again, like Jim mentioned, you don't want to get yourself stuck in a terrible tax trap. You want to make sure that this contribution you're making is beneficial for you and beneficial for the charity as well.
Next week, we're going to continue on with the concept of gifting. There's a whole set of tax rules for that to individuals. Let's say you want to make a gift at the end of the year. You have grandchildren. You'd like to fund a college education. Maybe you want to make gifts to your children. You have a large estate with a lot of income, maybe gifts to family members. So we're going to take up the topic of gifting to individuals. And there's a whole set of rules. As you can imagine, the IRS has rules for everything. Meanwhile, coming up next, we'll be talking with Lou Mazzillo about year-end tax planning right after this. Joining me on the program today is Lou Mazzello. He is a partner at McKenna Long in Aldridge. And Lou, beginning this year, we had a new tax law that went into effect that will apply to all income in 2013. It's based on a certain level of income, the tax bracket, but there's also things in terms of exemption phase-outs. I wonder if you would just briefly, for our listeners, talk about what those limits are before people get into those higher tax brackets.
Okay, well, first of all, we now have a 39.6% tax rate on income of married couples over $450,000, and for a person filing separately, $225,000, and a single filer, $400,000. This is an increase from 35% to 39.6%. In addition, there is a 20% tax on capital gains and qualified dividends. That's up from 15%, and that applies to income in the same categories that I mentioned before, $450,000 for joint filers, $400,000 for single filers, and then $225,000 if you're filing separately. So that's an increase from 15% to 20%, and the other increase on ordinary income was from 35% to 39.6%. There is also a phase-out of the personal exemption. Those dollar figures are different, unfortunately, very confusing, but the personal exemptions phases out beginning at $300,000 for a joint filer and a surviving spouse, $250,000 for a single filer. Of course, there are other categories, but I'm not going to go into each one of those with respect to each of these increases. That phase-out had gone away, but now it's back in. And then there's another phase-out for itemized deductions. And that 3% reduction in itemized deduction, not to exceed 80%, and that phase-out begins at $300,000 for joint filers and $250,000 for single filers. Now, that phase-out has the effect for somebody who is in the top income tax bracket, 39.6, of a 1.2% increase in the overall tax. I won't go into how that's calculated, but in other words, it's a 1.2% additional tax if you're over $450,000. Now, there is an additional tax that many people may not be aware of, and this was not part of the 2012 Taxpayer Relief Act. This actually was imposed by the Health Care and Education Reconciliation Act, which is part of the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. And this is two different taxes. One is an increase of 0.9% on compensation income. So that's a Medicare tax that's going to be now 3.8% on compensation income in excess of certain threshold amounts. And for a joint filer, that is $250,000. For a single filer, $200,000. So if you're receiving ordinary income in excess of those amounts, then there's an additional Medicare tax of 0.9% to bring the total amount to 3.8%. Now, the employer still pays the 2.9% that the employer paid prior to this new tax. By the way, this is a new tax for 2013, even though the act was passed some years ago. Now, in addition to that 0.9% increase in the Medicare tax on compensation, there is now a 3.8% tax on investment income. It's referred to as net investment income. So if you have this 3.8% tax, and I'll tell you when it comes into play, but if you take the 39.6% tax on ordinary income, and then you add another 3.8% tax on investment income, and then a 1.2% tax. Well, if you have capital gain, 20%, it would be 20% plus the 3.8% for this net investment tax, and then an additional 1.2% because of the phase out for itemized deductions. You're now at a total of 25% for federal income tax purposes. And then if you're in the highest bracket for California purposes, you have an additional 12.3% tax on top of that. So capital gain could be taxed as high as 37.3% if you're a California resident paying California taxes. Now, where does this net investment income tax come into play? For joint filers, if your income is $250,000, and if you are a single filer, $200,000. Now, For those of you who have trust set up, either you're a beneficiary of a trust or you've set up trust for your children or other persons, the net investment income tax actually applies for income over $11,950, very, very low amount. And that is also the threshold for the 39.6% income tax. So once you reach $11,950 in a trust, you are now paying the 39.6% maximum rate plus an additional 3.8% on net investment income. And that's going to put some pressure on trustees to distribute income to beneficiaries who may be in lower income tax brackets and may not be subject to the net investment income tax. So those are the major changes as far as the federal income tax rates. And of course, the California rates were in effect before.
So if we look at adding all this together, you have 39.6% at the federal level. You have the loss of itemized deductions, which could be another 1.2. You have the Medicare tax, which went up by 0.9% to 3.8. So you're at 44.6. And if we look at what the increase has been, we've gone from the 35% tax rate to the 39.6. So there's 4.6. You add the loss of itemized deductions, there's 1.2, and then you add the additional Medicare tax of 0.9. You know, that's almost 6.7, almost a 7 percentage point increase in the effective tax rate.
Actually, I'm looking at something where somebody calculated it, and it's a 27% increase for ordinary income, and actually for capital gain income, it's a 67% increase.
Wow.
Because you're going from 15% to 25%, because you've got the 20% once you're over the $450,000 amount, and then you've got the 3.8% for the net investment income tax, and then you've got an additional 1.2% because of the phase-out of itemized deductions.
So, Lou, given the fact that, I mean, if you take 44.6, you add 12.3, basically Uncle Sam and the governor takes more of your income than you do.
That's true. Now, we have to keep this in some perspective. None of us like to pay taxes. On the other hand, I remember when I first started practicing law, the tax on ordinary income was 70%, the maximum tax. And at one point during the war, during World War II and in the early 50s, the tax rate was 90%, the highest tax rate. I'm not saying this is great. I'm just saying that this is not the highest tax rates that we've ever faced.
No, but I can recall, Lou, when I got in the business, even though those tax rates were at 70%, I can remember I got tax shelters. I could write off real estate. I used to do 2-to-1, 3-to-1 tax shelters at the end of the year, zero out my income. We don't have those anymore.
That is true, because we have the passive loss rules that prevent you from taking in deductions for investments in which you are not actively participating, unless you also have income from those same types of investments.
I want to talk about, given this increase, almost a 27% increase in tax rates at the individual level, 67% on capital gains, it's the end of the year. We're in December. There's about 28 days left in the end of the year. What are some of the things individuals can do now to, let's say, reduce that tax rate? Because when you're talking about 44.6% federal, 12.3 here in the state of California, maybe less if you're living elsewhere. I mean, that's a hefty chunk of your income.
That's true. Now, unfortunately, if you're going to be in that same bracket in 2014, a lot of the things that you can do to reduce tax this year may not actually be advisable. But one thing you can do is to defer compensation to next year. For example, if you're employer was going to give you a bonus, or if it's your own company and you were going to pay out more to you in salary, you can defer that until 2014. And you could also accelerate deductions into 2013. For example, you could prepay state property taxes and state income estimated taxes. That would be one way, although what you have to be careful of when you're talking about accelerating deductions is that many deductions are not deductible, or at least not deductible to the fullest extent when you're dealing with the alternative minimum tax. And that is why some people suggest, and hopefully most of the people that will be listening to this have qualified CPAs, it may be advisable to sit down with your CPA between now and the end of the year and go through some of these things to determine whether or not it makes sense to defer income or to accelerate deductions. One simple thing to do, kind of a no-brainer, is make maximum contributions to qualified retirement plans, such as 401k plans and individual retirement accounts, assuming that you qualify to make a deductible contribution to an individual retirement account because you are participating in a qualified retirement plan. If you're self-employed and you don't have a self-employment retirement plan, you could set one up between now and the end of the year and, again, contribute to it. So that's another thing that you can do. One thing that has nothing to do with deferring the income, but actually may make sense, if you did a Roth rollover, a lot of wealthier people did Roth rollovers in 2013. If the value of what you rolled over has gone down, which hopefully it hasn't because the market's been very good, but if whatever you had invested in did go down, then you may want to recharacterize the Roth rollover as a traditional IRA so that you don't have to pay tax on that money, on that rollover for 2013. And then later, if you want to reconvert to a Roth IRA, you're able to do so. One thing you want to make sure you do is to take any required minimum distributions from qualified retirement plans and IRAs if you are 70 and a half or over to avoid the 50% tax that would apply to any required minimum distribution that was not made. And if you happen to turn 70 and a half in 2013, you can wait until April 1st of 2014 to take out the first required minimum distribution. The problem with that, if you wait until April 1 of 2014 to take out the first required distribution, you have to take out another required distribution before the end of 2014. So that would be bunching two required minimum distributions in the same year. So again, unfortunately, none of this stuff is simple. And that's why, again, it probably makes sense for wealthier people to sit down with their CPA before the end of the year.
When you take a look at probably one of the best things that you have out there, I mean, everybody is familiar with charitable contributions and itemized deductions like a mortgage deduction or state taxes. Unfortunately, as you pointed out, if you're at a certain level, they start phasing out about 3% of those itemized deductions, which increases your tax rate by the equivalent of 1.2%. But let's talk about pension contributions, and especially for those that run small businesses, because, Lou, depending on a person's age, you have 401ks, you have profit sharings, you have defined benefit pension plans. So, I mean, there are things that you can do. And to me, putting insulting away money in a 401k or pension plan, which comes right off the gross at the very top, let's talk about the importance of that, because that seems to me one of the best tax reduction plans that you can have out there.
Well, I would agree 100%. That's why I said earlier that you should make the maximum contributions that you're able to make to qualified retirement plans. It may be, depending upon your circumstances, that you may want to talk to a specialist in the employee benefit area, because depending upon your employment situation, if you're self-employed or you have your own corporation or your own limited liability company, there may be plans available where you can make substantial contributions to the retirement plan. And again, as you already mentioned, that comes right off the top. And in addition to that, the money is in an environment where there's not going to be any current tax on the returns on the investments until you actually take the money out.
Now, let's talk about something else that can help reduce taxable income, and this applies mainly for investors, and there's some other things that they could be doing. For example, if I'm a highly compensated employee, executive, or even in my own business, wouldn't it make more sense, things like tax-deferred annuities, where, let's say, I can go in a variable annuity, invest in the stock market, and not have any of the capital gains or dividends be included in my taxable income, or setting up a laddered or personal tax-free bond portfolio that's exempt from federal and state taxes?
Well, those are things you can do. I would be a little bit wary of, right now, bond portfolios because, as you know, the interest rates are at almost all-time lows. And if the Federal Reserve takes certain actions next year because the economy improves, bonds you purchase this year are going to be taking a beating. But I'm not an investment advisor, so I shouldn't even be mentioning that.
Well, I was thinking of somebody that had a laddered bond portfolio.
Even though capital gains are higher now than they were before for wealthier people, still the maximum federal rate is 25% as opposed to ordinary income, which is at 44.6%. So there's still a significant difference, and you need to be careful that you're not converting capital gain income into ordinary income.
So outside of a pension plan contribution, what about purchase qualified small business stock to avoid any tax on gain? What about things like that, or stock held in a C corporation?
Yes, that is something that makes a lot of sense, except that it's not going to save you any taxes this year. What will happen is if you hold the stock for 5 years and then you sell it, you buy the stock before the end of 2013, because this provision will expire at the end of 2013. If you buy the stock now and then after 5 years you sell it, you pay no tax on the gain. It's 100% reduction of tax, which is tremendous. But again, it's only going to be around for the rest of this year. Now, some of these provisions like this one may be extended, but with the atmosphere in Congress in Washington right now, I wouldn't count on any significant tax legislation, not only this year, but probably next year.
Are we going to get to the point, Lou, I guess, with all of this, where the government is taking more and more of what an individual takes? They're trying to get rid of itemized deductions. They're trying to get rid of exemptions. They're trying to raise the tax rates, which they've done. Do they get to the point where, I mean, it's just like fill out your tax return. This is what you make, and this is how much we take. This is what you have left. I mean, are we going to get to that in tax planning?
I don't think so, because, of course, right now we still have the Republicans in control of the House of Representatives. So I think that it's going to be very difficult for the Democrats who want to increase taxes on wealthier people to have tax increases. The only reason why we had these tax increases at the beginning in 2013, because these were already going to happen under the law if Congress did not do anything. So actually, it could have been worse if there wasn't some kind of a compromise at the end of 2012, or I guess in the first couple hours of 2013. But now that's gone, and so there's no tax increases that are scheduled to happen the same way that the tax increases were scheduled to happen in 2013. And so you're not going to have the same situation where the Democrats are going to be able to say to the Republicans, if you don't compromise, then we're just going to let these tax increases go. That's not the situation today. So I think as long as the Republicans control the House, it's unlikely that we're going to have additional tax increases in the foreseeable future. Now, again, I'm not a political scientist, but I know enough that we're not in that same situation that we were, because what happened is the Bush tax cuts, when Bush was president, those tax cuts were all temporary. That's the only way they could get them passed. And so that's why you had the situation in 2012 where if Congress didn't do anything, there was going to be a tax increase. And actually, the tax increase would have applied to people at a much lower level of income. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. So for the lower income under 400 single, let's say, and 450 for, let's say, a married couple, you're back at the old Bush tax rates. So it's only individuals that are above 400 and 450, and then, of course, 250, 300 for itemized deductions, you're okay.
And then you have the 250 for the net investment income tax. So if you're under 250, a married couple, or under 200,000 for a single person, then your federal income taxes have not gone up, and the same thing with respect to California taxes have not gone up. So it really is affecting wealthier people.
What about, Lou, I mean, just quite honestly, I mean, if you take California, which is up to, what, 12.3 or 13.3, depending on how you figure it, why not just move to another state like Texas, where the economy is booming, there is no income tax? I think there's, what, 9 or 10 states now that have no income tax?
Well, that's something that a lot of my clients have either considered or have actually done. In fact, I remember when I was practicing in Virginia, I had a number of wealthy clients that moved to Florida because Florida didn't have an income tax, and also now it doesn't have an estate tax. Of course, California does not have an estate tax, and it can't have one unless the Constitution is amended, and I don't think that's likely to happen. The downside of moving out of California, particularly if you live in places like where I live in Carlsbad and along the coast, the weather you can't beat. It's the best weather in the country, if not the world. So you're paying a higher tax because you're living in a better place to live. Not necessarily. You're probably paying a higher tax because the California General Assembly is spending your money ways that maybe is not in the best interest of the growth of the California economy. But again, I'm not a politician. So yes, you could move to another state. Now, one problem you have, if you move to another state and you really come back to California, and this is where you're going to spend most of your time, then the Board of Equalization is going to get you.
So outside of moving to another state, putting money in a pension, maybe trying some tax deferral, sounds to me, Lou, that the options are getting fewer and fewer.
Yeah, you know, well, of course, one thing that we haven't mentioned yet, and that is a charitable remainder trust. You could put assets into a charitable remainder trust, and then those assets could be sold, and there wouldn't be any tax on any of the gain. And then, of course, you would receive an annuity each year. That would be subject to tax depending upon the nature of the assets that are in the charitable remainder trust. But for a wealthier person, if the person transferred assets to a charitable remainder trust last year, the person was only getting a 15% from a federal tax standpoint benefit. Now that person's getting a 25% benefit. So there's more incentive to make charitable contributions, particularly to something like a charitable remainder trust, than there was before. Now, that's not necessarily good news. The reason for that is that the tax rate has gone up. But people should consider charitable planning as a way of avoiding taxes that they would otherwise not want to pay.
Now, what about things like subchapter S corporations, C corporations? Is there anything in terms of the way a business is set up that can minimize taxes?
Well, things that you can do if you have a business entity is, of course, to have retirement plans and so forth. But a lot of those you could do as a sole proprietor as well, although I would never want to do anything as a sole proprietor because of the exposure to liability. But again, there are deductions that you may be able to take, business deductions that may be more difficult if you didn't have a business entity established. But theoretically, if it's a business deduction, it's a business deduction, and you should be able to take it regardless. But again, this would be something that you would want to sit down with your tax advisor and determine what additional benefits you could derive from having a corporation or a limited liability company. And in most cases today, a limited liability company is going to be better because there are fewer restrictions than apply to an S corporation. And a C corporation, you always run into the situation where you could have a double level of tax if you sold the assets of the corporation at some point down the road. You avoid that double level of tax if you have an S corporation. And I would advise anybody, except in unusual circumstances, to either use an S corporation or a limited liability company to operate a business as opposed to a C corporation, because you never know when you may be able to sell the assets. And if you are in a pass-through entity like an S-corporation or limited liability company, you avoid the potential double-level tax. One thing we haven't talked about is estate planning, and I'm not going to go into any detail there, but one thing that people fail to realize, and that is that there is a gift tax annual exclusion. This year it's $14,000, and if you're married, it can be $28,000, even if only one of the couple makes the gift, because you can elect to treat the gift as made one-half by each. And the issue here is if you don't use the annual exclusion in any given year, it's gone. In other words, if I don't make the $14,000 gift to my child this year, next year I can't say to the government, well, I didn't use it last year, so now I want to make a $14,000 gift for last year and another $14,000 gift for 2014. You can't do that. And so people who are in the position where they can afford to make those gifts should make those gifts before the end of the year. One of the things that you have to be careful of, if you make a gift by check, that check has to be deposited in the bank before the end of the year to make sure that you are able to take the annual exclusion.
So outside of making some gifts and then also things like setting up a living trust where the exemption is $5.25 million, where you can double that for a husband and wife, anything else outside, like say a charitable remainder trust where you can transfer an asset, avoid the capital gains, and get the income?
Well, I mentioned the charitable remainder trust earlier. So, yes, that's definitely something to do if you're charitably inclined. There are also other techniques that you can use in order to take advantage of your $5 million. Actually, in 2014, it's going to be $5,340,000 each. But this year, as you correctly pointed out, it's $5,250,000 that you could set up an irrevocable trust for the benefit of your children and grandchildren. Now, not everyone is in a situation where they can afford to make those kinds of gifts, But there are other techniques that you could use in order to reduce your transfer tax base. In other words, what's going to be either subject to gift tax or estate tax when you die. And some of those are like a sale to a grantor trust or setting up a family limited partnership or setting up a so-called grantor retained annuity trust. All of these things can result in a reduction in gift and estate taxes, but these are all things that you would need to discuss with a qualified estate planning professional. Usually it would be an attorney, but the CPAs and other people can point you in the right direction as to some of these techniques.
So as we sum up here, Lou, just some final thoughts. You know, if you could just do 1, 2, 3 steps to consider as we get closer to the end of the year, what would they be?
Sit down with your CPA and kind of decide what your tax situation is going to be for 2013. And if there are things that you can do to reduce that, taking into account the potential alternative minimum tax consequences. The second thing is to make sure you're making maximum contributions to any retirement plans that you are participating in or that you could set up before the end of the year. And then third, the annual exclusion amount for gift tax purposes to make sure that you're taking advantage of something that if you don't use it, you lose it.
Well, listen, Lou, I want to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. If listeners here in California would like to find out more about the tax planning work that your firm does, how could they do so, please?
Well, they just go onto our website, and then they can just kind of go through that. That'll direct them to our tax people or our estate planning people. That would be the easiest way to do it.
Well, listen, Lou, as always, good to speak with you again. You have yourself a nice holiday and a prosperous new year.
And the same to you. Thanks a lot for great questions.
Well, that concludes my interview. Folks, please do yourself a favor, and especially if you're in those higher tax brackets, whether you're single or you're a married couple. As you mentioned, there's three different categories. Everybody's thinking of the tax bracket. If you're $400,000, if you're single, $450,000 if you're married. But there's three other brackets as well. There's another bracket for losing your exemptions, and there's another bracket for phasing out your itemized deductions. All of those added together. And then there's another bracket for whether you pay the additional capital gains tax. So don't wait to the end of the year, the last minute, during the Christmas holidays when nobody's going to be available and your choices are going to be limited, especially if you want to set up something like a pension plan that it gives you the ability, if you set the paperwork up now, you can get the deduction and you have till next year to pay for it. So do yourself a favor, go call your financial planner, call your CPA and say, you know what, let's sit down, take a look at what it's going to be like because folks, tax rates have gone up. If you're in California, they went up last year. If you live in the United States, federal taxes went up for many people and they're not even aware of it. So on behalf of myself, Jim Poplava, and Kathleen Harris, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.